Okay, I think we are set for today. And so welcome everybody. we are on the same chapter, Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti, in the Life Divine. And this is page number... does somebody have the page number in the latest edition? I am using an old volume, so if somebody can tell us where we are.
348.
And the paragraph is the one beginning, the same conciliation occurs everywhere, right?
Right.
Yeah, very good. So, to reconnect us, last time we did one long paragraph. And this chapter, as I pointed out, is the second chapter in the second part of the Life Divine, which part is about the infinite consciousness and the ignorance, or the problem of knowledge, in a sense. So here the first chapter was about indeterminates and the cosmic determination. And this second chapter is trying to extend the ideas of that chapter and explain the paradox that has been introduced in that chapter. Which paradox is the fact that the paradox of necessity and chaos, in other words, that there is something completely indeterminable, something that we cannot know, almost unknowable, something that escapes all laws. That's one way of understanding chaos. Normally, when we use the word chaos, we think of randomness and disorder. But randomness and disorder are also descriptions for that which escapes all formulations of order, or anything that we can call order. And as we know that there are statistical ways by which we can understand even those types of things, and that's why we have something called chaos theory, which has emerged in modern mathematics. So, wait a minute, I think somebody is trying to call. Okay, so Matteo is in the group, but he's not showing up. So in any case, I just acknowledge that. So we have these two factors, and these two factors are constantly at play. One is that of an incomprehensible universe, something that we can never understand. And the other is that of a universe that is ordered by laws, some of which we can understand, and the rest we don't yet know. Just a moment, let me...
Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah. So, we are continuing to talk about indeterminates and the cosmic determination. And Sri Aurobindo raises the whole issue and points out that indeed there is something completely indeterminable about the cosmos, yet we are faced by a number of determinants. The determinants belong to the cosmos, and we can either look upon this cosmos as being completely indeterminate, something unknowable, or something knowable. You know, these are two kind of poles of the spectrum. If we look at it as something completely determined, then we are talking about a clockmaker universe, which was one of the intuitions of the modern age, which spawned the entire great, you know, sort of enterprise of science and the quest to know all the laws of the universe, which seeded what we call the Enlightenment. And on the other hand, we have the other side, which assumes that there are ultimately no laws, and that really that there is a kind, it ends up in a kind of nihilism, a nihilism of supposing that there is no meaning to the cosmos. The cosmos is meaningless. So between these two poles, what is the truth? And is there a kind of a mediation between these two? Sri Aurobindo points out in that first chapter that both are true. There is a true truth to both sides. And because we are on this side, the cosmic side of the equation, because we do not have access to what is beyond, we seem to privilege the logic of the finite, as he calls it. The logic of the finite is an investment in discreteness. We are discrete, we are separate, and we use our minds from that vantage of separation, and hence it's a sort of a logical finiteness that we deal in. This causes certain problems, and he ends that chapter by talking about the fact that, you know, he is presenting a different kind of reality, a reality which is infinite, and where that which is indeterminate is determining itself in certain ways. So the self-determination of the illimitable and ultimately indeterminate absolute is what is occurring. And then he provides a certain kind of schema to tell us that what is the principle along which this determination is taking place. So that it's like almost like, what is the seed idea from which all the other ideas of cosmic determination spring? And this he proposes as the notion of involution and evolution, that in a way that the illimitable infinite has perceived itself or is perceiving itself as a gradation of levels of consciousness that are emerging from a original self-loss. It seems to lose itself completely in its opposite. The opposite of pure consciousness is the inconscience, though there is not the opposite of pure existence, being, which in spiritual terms is called sat or existence, becomes another kind of pure existence which is bereft of consciousness, and that we can call matter. So matter is like the dark absolute of spirit. And out of that, the emergent properties of spirit then begin coming out in manifestations which are discrete. That's the other kind of fall. The fall from consciousness to the inconscience, and the fall from indivisibility to what we may call particulation or discreteness. So these two become the ground zero from which the sort of emergence of higher forms of consciousness occur, along with the variations of discrete, existence, that ultimately become more and more conscious of their unity and indivisibility. So this is what Sri Aurobindo is proposing, and then in this chapter he's coming to a kind of explanation of that in terms of the three statuses of being. And the three statuses of being, even in terms of knowledge, we may see that the Upanishads have already proposed three statuses of knowledge. They are the known, the unknown, and the unknowable. And so the unknowable is the indeterminate or indeterminable. And the unknown is the determinable but not determined. And then we have the known, which is the world of determinations. Now here he's introducing three terms which are Brahman, Purusha and Ishvara. Or sometimes he calls them Atman, Purusha and Ishvara. And so the Brahman pole, which is ultimately the transcendent, Brahman is the term used for all of these polarities. So Brahman is all there is, and hence it is conscious being itself. And this conscious being has got other properties within it, but it is by itself completely free. And its infinite freedom is what makes it indeterminable. But it presents itself in a form which is a plane of consistency, something which can look like it has order because it is mediated by an ordering principle, what Sri Aurobindo calls the real idea. Now, this mediating principle, therefore, is something that Brahman is putting forward. And because it is a principle of order, it's a principle that is the source of order. Therefore, to the ordered world, it stands as the ordering master. It has the relationship of master to the world that it subtends, that controls in terms of order. So that's the reason why this second term is known as Ishvara. Ishvara literally means the one who has will. Ish is will. And Ishvara is the one who possesses will. And hence, the will of the one that has gone forth into the world as a coherence, as a form of, ordered reality, is the will of the Ishvara. Hence, Ishvara mediates between Brahman and the world of discrete entities that are driven by some force both within them as well as outside them, of which they are not completely aware, but which they can intuit as having an order and also having a certain indescribable indeterminability. So we see that these are the two primary manifestations of Brahman in its descent, as one may say, from the pole of pure freedom to the pole of boundedness. And then we have the world of discrete entities, and at that level, that same master that we talked about as Ishvara experiences itself as in each individual as a witness. And the witness is observing the laws of the universe and of the inner being working themselves out and being a participant. So the jiva, the living creature, the living being, is a participant on the one hand in the activities of these principles or laws, and on the other hand is a witness to these activities. So we have three stations through which the descent of determination is taking place. This is how this chapter connects with the previous chapter. So the descent of determination starts from the indeterminable, who self-determines through its own power of ideation. And that power of ideation and action, concentration of force, is what is the other pole. So Brahman's power of ideation and manifestation is Maya. That then stands in the relationship of master to the ordered universe, the coherent universe. So at the head of the cosmic, between the transcendental and the cosmic, stands the Ishvara. The Ishvara also has its will, which is manifest through its power, which is its Shakti. And the Shakti of the Ishvara produces a cosmos in which the Ishvara is born or reborn as all the discrete entities within, and hence becomes the Purusha in each discrete entity, observing the cosmic action of Shakti. Now, last time I also clarified that these three terms, Brahman, Purusha, and Ishwara are actually coming to us from three different schools of philosophy and three different layers of time in what one might call the archaeology of Indian philosophy. So, Brahman and Purusha are coming to us from the Vedas. Actually, the Purusha originates in the Veda, but the meaning of Purusha in the Veda is equivalent to Brahman. Brahman occurs in the Upanishads. Purusha also occurs in the Upanishads, but without the idea or without the term Prakriti being used. Ishwara occurs in the Upanishads, but becomes much more prominent in the Gita and in the later Puranas and Tantras. And we find that Purusha occurs in the Sankhya with its counterpart Prakriti. So these different forms of philosophy over time start getting a certain kind of integration. The Gita itself is an integration of these philosophies and, presents all three of them. And then later schools, the Puranic schools, are also integrations of these three philosophies. So by the time Sri Aurobindo is dealing with them, we can look at them as a single system, and he is integrating them in a specific way. So that's where we stand as far as these three are concerned. And where we are right now in the chapter on Brahman, Purusha and Ishwara, last time he began, first he introduced these three terms, and then he began rehearsing the previous paragraph, previous chapter, because he's trying to connect the two. And the last paragraph that we read is a critical paragraph in which he reintroduces the idea of indeterminates and the cosmic determinations, and makes that same point about what is completely or illimitably free and what is determined, and points out that the indeterminable has determined itself, that we are caught in what one might call the logic of the finite, but we have to utilize the logic of the infinite. Now, one thing to note is that he's making the point in that previous paragraph, and he has made that point earlier, that the idea of a clockmaker universe, the idea of an ordered universe, which is what he's calling the logic of the finite, is an investment in discreteness. In other words, discreteness, particulation, separate instances, separation as we experience the world, is something which one part of our mind wants to take all the way down. In other words, we want to decompose this particulation to a universal particulation. We want to say that everything that we see as separate entities can ultimately be broken down, and we can keep breaking it down till we come to an indestructible particle that we call the atom. That's one way of looking at it. And then if we crack the atom, perhaps we come up with what we call subatomic particles. But we are thinking that at some point there will be certain subatomic particles, quarks or whatever you call them, that cannot be divided any further. Now, that kind of view, which would then follow the logic of the finite to its, what one might call its bitter end, is something that cannot take account of the indeterminability and freedom of the cosmos. So if we want to do that, then we find that we are having to use another kind of logic, which is the logic of the infinite. And in a sense, mathematics is moving in that direction when it creates a kind of a probabilistic theory with which to look upon the cosmos. And there too, there are certain indeterminables that we can only empirically establish as they come up, as they emerge, rather than know them beforehand. There are emergent properties that are invisible and that are, constantly emerging. So this is, in a sense, what he feels. But he's also saying that this investment in discreteness is not necessary. That this is also an attitude that we take. We take the attitude of discreteness and separation because that is one particular intuition of reality that we are following, the intuition of visible separation. But the inner mind, so the outer mind, so remember, if we talk about modes of knowledge, Sri Aurobindo has introduced the modes of direct and indirect knowledge. So normally with our senses, we see discrete entities and we obtain indirect knowledge, knowledge by external contact. But if we turn within, with the inner mind, we already begin coming to another hazy interface, a more fuzzy interface where what one might call discreteness and the sort of indivisibility of things are more connected with one another. And we seem to bypass the separation of external contact and have some kind of internal, either direct or indirect contact. An internal indirect contact or an internal direct contact in forms of inner intuition. Now, the inner mind itself begins to have those properties. So Sri Aurobindo is saying in this chapter that we finished last time that the problem is really a problem of mental investment. And we don't need to necessarily, hype up that problem if we start opening up subtler forms of mentation which have not necessarily the logic of the finite, but which are tending towards the logic of the infinite, which really belongs to the indivisible consciousness of the indeterminable. So I think at that point, we can move on to the next paragraph. And if there are any questions or comments, we can discuss them and move on.
Devishish, I have a question.
Yeah, John.
It seems that Mateo is trying to get back onto the call also.
He's already on.
Okay.
I just got on. Thanks, John Robert.
Oh, okay. When I was in Oroville, there was a biologist from Harvard who came to Oroville. He was traveling in India and he was looking for a new way to approach science. He was the head of the evolutionary biology department at Harvard, and that department had been made for him. It was a Russian biologist. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, he described how he and his students were trying to understand life. That was his basic question: what is life? Mm-hmm. He's a biologist, obviously. Mm-hmm. And doing film and observing the individual frames of the film. I don't remember whether it was digital or analog at the time.
Right.
Trying to gather from that what is the essence of life. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't really satisfied with that approach. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, it seems like Sri Aurobindo is offering something here to the scientific view that's missing in a lot of the scientific effort. And I wonder, what would you say someone who's already a scientist but is looking for something beyond, what could he do?
Yeah, that's a very profound question, John Robert. One thing is that already we see that paradigms of science are moving in a direction which makes them confront the paradox of the logic of the finite. So we find that particularly in physics, with quantum physics, where the weird phenomena of quantum physics completely flout the logic of the finite. And when that happens, then you have to come up with explanations. How, why does that happen? And that has opened a door to consciousness-based explanations, which essentially are saying that, you know, say even what one might call at one spectrum, and I will defer over here to others who know more than me in this subject, but, you know, at one end of the spectrum, we are talking about, you know, the uncertainty principle, which allows us to see, I mean, if we try to get as close as possible to these so-called particles, we can't really locate them. They're fuzzy in their location. They're what they call a probability cloud. So this fuzziness is not only just our lack of limitation of ability with our measuring instruments, but the limitation of measurement itself. And that's the, exactly a kind of a, we have come to a sort of a dead end for the logic of the finite. We have to assume that there is a haziness between the, at the bottom of the finite scale, which moves into something which is no longer possible to call finite. And then one of the ways of explaining it is that this transition from the indivisible to the divided is taking place through this hazy interface, which we cannot really see using, I mean, as long as we are in the finite domain. But if by some process we can enter the consciousness of the infinite or of the indivisible, then we might be able to experience that that limit, you see, that crossover. So that is one thing at the level of physics, and I will defer to others like maybe Keka or Dan Wood or anybody else who might like to say something about this. But I'd also like to point out that at similarly, at the level of life, or the origins of life, you know, experiments have been carried out where they are trying to find out what is the most elementary living molecule or, you know, biochemical substance. And they don't really have an answer to the question, but they're finding a number of complex hydrocarbons which seem to begin exhibiting the properties of life when put under pressure. So what is it that makes them, you know, become full-fledged living things? And what is that interface? How does that property emerge? Is again moving from something which is finite and ordered and defined to something mysterious trying to emerge. Gilles Deleuze, who I've talked about sometimes, is somebody who has been talking about biology and about life, given a lot of importance to the notion of the rhizome, what he calls the rhizomatic, and contrasts that to what he calls the arboretic, or the arboreal, that which pertains to the tree. Now, the tree is finitely differentiated. The tree's differentiations can be predicted almost, that there is a certain kind of logic order to the way in which the tree is differentiating, and the various parts of the tree, the roots, the stems, the trunk, the leaves, fruit, flowers, etc. But in the rhizome, any point of the rhizome is infinitely fertile and can actually manifest any other sort of organ. Like from the same point, you may get a root or a stem or a flower. And this kind of potency, the infinite potency of life in every particle, again, goes back to that same sort of a interface between the indivisible and the divided, you see, which shows us that there are ways by which we can think about a certain kind of hidden interface. The finite can't go beyond the fuzziness of that interface, but it also acknowledges a transition, a phase transition from the indivisible to the divided. I think that is one of the ways in which modern science is trying to cope with this and opening up the doors to consciousness-based explanations. Would somebody else like to say something on this?
Well, there's also, in physics, there's also there's a kind of a classic experiment that that was part of what Einstein did, where non-locality was illustrated, where there's instant communication between two electrons that are farther away than even the speed of light could produce communication. And they instantly know when something changes in each other and react together with that. And so the communication is beyond what we know of to be methods of communication of the finite that we're aware of. This is another area where the infinite appears in a way that's unexplainable so far.
Yes, indeed. Yes, these are some of what are called the weird phenomena of quantum physics at the sort of microscopic level and consciousness-based explanations. There are many explanations for this, and even among consciousness-based explanations, there are several. And of course, they tend towards this idea of the indivisible becoming divided.
Tika here, regarding this non-locality paradox, it's actually a thought experiment of Einstein, and it was in reaction to the Copenhagen, the Niels Bohr's interpretation of the double slit experiment, quantum explanation of that, which what it says is a pair which suppose something is having clockwise spin and the other is always anticlockwise. There are lots of pairs concepts in quantum theory like that, in subatomic principles in general. So it seems that even when we get down to having one particle coming out at a time, it's still that pair mechanism is still intact, meaning it is still the other particle of the pair is behaving as if they are still together and are trying to sort of complement each other. So that since the complementing principle is still going on, that is why Einstein questioned it, that how can that be possible, because if that has to be possible, it is that the communication is taking place between two particles at a distance speed faster than light, right, which is not possible. So basically that is it's like, why is it called non-locality paradox? Is because, which we know to be locally possible, meaning if things are together, then they can complement each other like a pair of particles. But if it is non-local, meaning they're not together, that is a paradox. So, the interpretation of Copenhagen or rather Niels Bohr has never really said that the communication is taking place. They are just saying that the phenomena of all the experimental phenomena will be supported I mean, unless an observation is made, so which means that it doesn't, I mean, how it is happening, it is not really answering. What it is saying is that it will happen. Meaning, it could be many other ways. It is non-locality, the way thought experiment was done by Einstein is one of the possible ways to think of, but there could be other ways. That's the whole reason why I tried, I mean, I'm even talking about this right now, is that there are other also possible ways, like actually that knowledge of how I will be could be latent in, you know, in each of the part, the member of that pair. Meaning, it's not, I mean, we are looking at it as if they have to know each other in order to complement each other. But that may be one of the possible ways to interpret, but that is not the only way to interpret. So, in other words, if it is, if the division is, as Shobindu says, that the whole matter is one undifferentiated reality, which is phenomenally divided by universal mind, which means that the two particles that we are thinking of separate are actually never separate. It's just that the mind, universal mind, not our individual mind, universal mind is making this whole complex operation, which is, sort of creating this phenomena, and when we are digging far enough, we see that our gap of understanding of this complex phenomena, I mean complex, you know, logic of this universal mind, how it makes it appear the way we see the world. When we get to that above quantum scale, like not small enough. So basically, universal mind, we can think of like the universal mind has created all these principles work in such manner that everything looks normal to us. Whereas if we dig down like in a quantum scale, then we see certain paradoxical phenomena, how it is really managing. But, could be a mental principle which is creating it. I mean, universal mental principle. So, moving faster than light is one possible way when it is actually thinking that actually the particle is moving, but actually it may not move at all.
I know that Einstein's original idea was a thought experiment, but my understanding was, I think in the 1980s sometime, there actually was an experiment done that confirmed this thought experiment is actually taking place. Do you know about that?
No, I do not. Sorry, my mic was muted. No, I do not know about that. But what I'm saying is that nothing has been proved to actually move faster than light. The experiment was that, it was that it is like an argument. Well, if the Copenhagen interpretation has to be right, then this has to move like this. So it's like thought experiment to explain how absurd the Copenhagen interpretation is. That is the argument of absurdity from Einstein.
So, yes, you were saying something, Joanna? Yeah.
I was just thanking Keiko because it appeared that there was communication faster than light in that, but of course that may not, that certainly may not be the explanation, but that's a good point.
Yeah. So, if that is the case, then as Keiko was pointing out, that indivisible reality, Can you hear me still? Hello?
Actually, Einstein is the one who's proposed through his theory of relativity that nothing can move faster than light and remain as matter.
Yeah. So, so we see these limits. On the one hand, if you can talk about the speed of light as one of the necessary conditions of manifest reality, then that also is both a limit as well as a determination. And if there is something that is exceeding that, then that also is a weird phenomenon, what one might call a weird phenomenon. Matteo, I think your mic is on, if you can mute it. Yeah. So we find that, and if this is also true, this is one way of looking at it, that actually there is no separation, and that separation is taking place through an act of universal mind, which is causing this phenomenal, existence to, the phenomenology of separated existence to appear. Then what we can say also is that this division into Brahman, Purusha and Ishvara is also ultimately just one thing. There is only Brahman. That's what it comes to. But Brahman can appear as if it is also Ishvara, and then it can also appear as if it is also Purusha and Prakriti. So these are the kind of stations of that self-appearance, as it were. And that self-appearance has consequences in the movement from the one to the many. And I think in this particular phase of this chapter, what Sri Aurobindo is trying to do is to create that transition through these paragraphs from the indeterminable to the what are the consequences of this difference between the logic of the finite and the logic of the infinite, between the polarities that it subtends and what lies underneath those polarities, the indivisibility that lies underneath them. That's what he's bringing up. So I think with that we can begin this paragraph. The same conciliation occurs everywhere. John Robert, would you like to read that paragraph? It's a longish paragraph. Thank you.
The same conciliation occurs everywhere when we look with a straight and accurate look on the truth of the reality. In our experience of it, we become aware of an infinite, essentially free from all limitation by qualities, properties, features. On the other hand, we are aware of an infinite teeming with innumerable qualities, properties, features. Here again, the statement of illimitable freedom is positive, not negative. It does not negate what we see, but on the contrary, provides the indispensable condition for it. It makes possible a free and infinite self-expression in quality and feature. A quality is the character of a power of conscious being. Or we may say that the consciousness of being expressing what is in it makes the power it brings out recognizable by a native stamp on it, which we call quality or character. Courage as a quality is such a power of being. It is a certain character of my consciousness expressing a formulated force of my being, bringing out or creating a definite kind of force of my nature in action. So too, the power of a drug to cure is its property, a special force of being native to the herb or mineral from which it is produced. And this specialty is determined by the real idea concealed in the involved consciousness which dwells in the plant or mineral. The idea brings out in it what was there at the root of its manifestation and has now become and has now come out thus empowered as the force of its being. All qualities, properties, features are such powers of conscious being thus put forth from itself by the Absolute. It has everything within it. It has the free power put all forth. Yet we cannot, it has the free power to put all forth. Yet we cannot define the Absolute as a quality of courage or a power of healing. We cannot even say that these are the characteristic feature of the Absolute. Nor can we make up a sum of qualities and say that is the Absolute. But neither can we speak of the Absolute as a pure blank incapable of manifesting these things. On the contrary, all capacity is there. The powers of all qualities and characters are there inherent within it. The mind is in a difficulty because it has to say, the Absolute or Infinite is none of these things. These things are not the Absolute or Infinite. And at the same time, it has to say, the Absolute is all these things. They are not something else than that. For that is the sole existence and the all existence. Here it is evident that it is an undue finiteness of thought conception and verbal expression which creates the difficulty. But there is in reality none. For it would be evidently absurd to say that the Absolute is courage or curing power, or to say that courage and curing power are the Absolute. But it would be equally absurd to deny the capacity of the Absolute to put forth courage or curing power as self-expressions in its manifestation. When the logic of the finite fails us, we have to see with a direct and unbound vision what is behind in the logic of the infinite. We can then realize that the infinite is infinite in quality, feature, power, but that no sum of qualities, features, powers can describe the infinite.
So Sri Aurobindo starts this exploration of the indeterminable and the determinate by taking up this notion of qualities. And so this is, what in the Indian terminology are called the Nirguna and the Anantaguna. Nirguna, without any qualities, and Anantaguna having infinite qualities. So this, without any qualities, it sometimes seems to be a negative description of Brahman. But it is a negative description because it's a door only to that which is transcendent of whatever we can call the sum total of qualities that have been manifested. Something which is beyond whatever has been manifested seems to be indefinable. And that's why it's sometimes given a negative definition. But this negative definition only hides a kind of a overflowing plenitude of positivity. So we have this Anantaguna, infinite quality, being of infinite qualities, that puts forth qualities. And Sri Aurobindo has this footnote about this putting forth. It says the word for creation in Sanskrit means a losing or putting forth, losing meaning unlosing, putting forth of what is in the being. You know, Srij is the root he's talking about there. Srij, from which Srishti comes, to create. But Srij means to put forth, to put out, throw out, press out. So we have this as the beginning idea, and he points out how the two contradictions having something which is beyond all qualities and something which is present or puts forth qualities. The absolute or infinite is none of these things. These things are not the absolute or infinite, which is the definition, the negative definition, nirguna. And then on the other hand, the absolute is all these things. They are not something else than that. For that is the sole existence, and the all existence is the ananta guna, the one that is the fountain of all qualities, and each quality is nothing but that itself. See, and now he starts with qualities also, because qualities are subjective. Of course, there can be objective qualities like color, form, shape, etc. are objective qualities. Courage, as he's talking about it, is a subjective quality. You know, the property of something to cure is an objective quality. But they also act subjectively. Color is received by us in subjective terms. We are cured by the curative property, etc. So these subjective qualities are, in Latin, the experience of a subjective quality is called a qualia. So our experiences are made up of distinct qualities of experience. They are all qualia. We experience qualia. So just like atoms of material particles, discrete experience is made up also of atomic qualities of experience that can be called qualia. However, that also is an appearance only. It's an appearance of something that has infinite qualities and putting forth a certain quality of experience for being experienced discreetly at any moment. See? So that is what he's pointing out over there, and he's making the point that to look at these things in discrete terms is also an investment in discreteness, as I said earlier. That's why he's saying it is evident that it is an undue finiteness of thought conception and verbal expression which creates the difficulty. But there is in reality none, for it would be evidently absurd to say that the absolute is courage or curing power, or to say that courage and curing power are the absolute. But it would be equally absurd to deny the capacity of the absolute to put forth courage or curing power as self-expressions in its manifestation. So that is how we find that this finiteness of thought conception and verbal expression can have degrees. You know, like we say, words can be denotative and connotative. A word which we use in science tends to need to be defined within very precise boundaries so that we can agree about the experience that is connected with it. But even in doing so, we are actually using a certain type of investment, an investment in discreteness. On the other hand, if we use words poetically, then there is a certain fuzziness to it, just like, you know, the indeterminability of the particle, which is, you know, sort of fuzzy. In the same way, there is a fuzziness to the term, but it's a subjective fuzziness, which gives us many different possibilities that cluster around that particular word or usage. And behind that, there is something even more profound. We sense a universality. So that is what he's pointing out over here, in terms of the absolute, the and the finite, and the logic of the finite and the logic of the infinite, and qualities and their manifestation. We could move on to the next paragraph if you wish, because he will go now to different aspects of this indeterminability, determinability spectrum. He looks at qualitative existence And in the next paragraph, he's going to look at the distinction between the one and the many. See, again, it's that's the notion of division. What is essential objectively? So qualities can be experienced subjectively, but numerical separation or division is an objective division, and he's going to come to that in the next paragraph. So, would somebody else, Margaret, would you like to read the next paragraph?
Yes, I can read the next one.
Sure.
We see that the absolute, the self, the divine, the spirit, the being is one. The transcendental is one. The cosmic is one. But we see also that beings are many, and each has a self, a spirit, a like yet different nature. And since the spirit and essence of things is one, we are obliged to admit that all these many must be that one, and it follows that the one is or has become many. But how can the limited or relative be the absolute? And how can man or beast or bird be the divine being? But in erecting this apparent contradiction, the mind makes a double error. It is thinking in the terms of the mathematical finite unit, which is soul in limitation, the one which is less than two and can become two only by division and fragmentation, or by addition and multiplication. But this is an infinite oneness. It is the essential, an infinite oneness, which can contain the hundred and the thousand and the million and billion and trillion. Whatever astronomic or more than astronomic figures you heap and multiply, they cannot overpass or exceed that oneness. For in the language of the Upanishad, it moves not, yet is always far in front. When you would pursue and seize it, it can be said of it that it would not be the infinite oneness if it were not capable of an infinite multiplicity. But that does not mean that the one is plural, or can be limited or described as the sum of the many. On the contrary, it can be the infinite many because it exceeds all limitation or description by multiplicity and exceeds at the same time all limitation by finite conceptual oneness. Pluralism is an error because, though there is the spiritual plurality, the many souls are dependent and interdependent existences. Their sum also is not the one, nor is it the cosmic totality. They depend on the one and exist by its oneness. Yet the plurality is not unreal. It is the one soul that dwells as the individual in these many souls, and they are eternal in the one and by the one. Eternal. This is difficult for the mental reason, which makes an opposition between the infinite and the finite, and associates finiteness with plurality and infinity with oneness. But in the logic of the infinite, there is no such opposition, and the eternity of the many in the one is a thing that is perfectly natural and possible.
So here, as you can see, he's conducting the same kind of analysis of oneness and plurality, the one and the many, and it's a very profound point, because this has been one of the primary initiating problems of philosophy, particularly as it has come to us from people like the pre-Socratics of Greece. what is true, the one or the many? And as he's pointing out over here, this problem pursues us to our own time, because we live in a world of plurality. We live in a world of differences, and yet we yearn for unity. And yet, what has happened, particularly if we look at this as an ethical and a political problem, any unity that we may artificially try to construct, and even if we try to posit a certain unity, in the world of finites, in the world of separates, in the world of differences, we end up with what is called a kind of fascism. We are trying to club together a sum total of plurals under a certain rubric, and immediately there will be some other plurals which escape from it or get subjugated by it. So plurality, which means radical differentiation, is something that cannot, in the finite sense, be compatible with a oneness. It is at the very other end. If we start with a oneness, then we can talk about a plurality, which is the self-division of the oneness. But even there, we are then actually saying that there is no real radical difference between the particles. Here what Sri Aurobindo is saying is that there is a certain kind of oneness which is not a finite oneness, which is a truly infinite oneness. An infinite oneness contains plurality as its property, because it is truly infinite. That oneness cannot even see its own ends. It cannot be limited by any sum of, of entities. So that is basically the point he's making. That again, by positing a certain kind of distinct finite reality, we lose sight of, we are made to lose sight, shall we say. It isn't that we do this as something which is a kind of a human will, but it is part of human experience, the discreteness of human experience, and investing in that makes us lose this intuition and ultimately experience of the infinite one. Now that is Brahman. Brahman is the infinite one. And Brahman is always and everywhere present. And that's the thing about, the division that took place that actually never took place. The many that emerged that were always and are always the one. Interesting again that we, last paragraph I was talking about the rhizomatic notion of Gilles Deleuze. In a similar vein, he points to the equation of being in the plane of, what he calls the plane of immanence, which one can equate with the Brahman, that within which everything is, and says that the primary quality of that is monism is equal to pluralism. In other words, it is the infinite one. Monism, there is only one and nothing else, and yet it is completely infinite. It is plural. So if there's no questions, maybe we can move on to one more.
I have one question here.
Yeah, yes, John Robert.
So when Sri Aurobindo talks about the logic of the infinite in these paragraphs, it seems like to me he's not talking about something that's beyond the human mind, that he's talking about kind of characteristic, way that we use the mind, the logic of the finite, but this logic of the infinite he's talking about, it seems like to me he's justifying it logically by saying that if you separate the one and the many, for example, then you're putting a limitation on the one, on the infinity of the one. So he's really appealing to something that's graspable by our own logic. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, I think you're getting that right, John Robert, but I think there's limits there. It's again the same thing about the determinate and the indeterminable. What he's calling the logic of the infinite and what he's telling us here, the paradoxical, that can be transcended or that can be bridged if we put these together, has to account for a reality which is one and infinite at the same time. But the question is, do we experience it like that? And what he's saying is that we do and we don't. See, we don't experience it like that if we talk about our sense reality and the way in which the mind, sort of interprets sense reality as distinct entities that we are in relation with. But at the same time, what he has pointed out even in the earlier chapter is that the inner mind is subliminal and something that is connected to dimensions of oneness. So as he's pointing out, plurality is not true in itself, because all these entities are interdependent and dependent and interdependent. So these entities are ultimately tied to one another. That is a certain sense of oneness. They're inextricably bound to one another. That is a level of oneness that the inner mind is conscious of. It's conscious also of the fuzzy borders of every entity, both in terms of its objective appearance as well as in terms of its subjective qualia and its idea. You see, so we find that certain ideas morph into other ideas, and we can see how those ideas are present in the discrete entities that we see. And if we look at those more connotative, fuzzy, and sort of flexible realities, then we immediately start passing out of the logic of the finite towards a logic of the infinite. We can see the tendency towards that. But to actually reach that with, as you're saying, with the mind, we need to transcend the properties of the mind, of the human mind, that are tied to the operation of the senses. And we are invited to that journey of yoga, where indeed we can even change the properties of our senses by opening them to latencies of other powers of sensing. And then as far as the mind itself is concerned, this is an invitation to traverse the ranges of mind above the human mind, which bring us into contact with greater and greater unities that still remain within the realm of the unknown. So between the known and the unknowable is the entire spectrum of the unknown, which we can contact through what Sri Aurobindo calls the levels of the overhead planes, the cosmic mind planes. But the ultimate experience of what he's talking about is not available to the mind. The ultimate experience of what he's talking about can be intuited up to the level of the overmind, and only in certain parts of the heights of the overmind is it an actual experience. And then beyond that, it is the reality itself. That is the supermind. That is where he's getting to. But he's preparing the ground by honing our intuition in the direction of that experience.
But it seems to me that in this part, he's not taking us into the intuitive mind and the overhead planes. It seems like he's starting off with just an appeal to logic by saying that we're looking at, say, one of these dualities, like the one and the many, from a certain point of view, but it's equally logical, just even from our point of view, to say that if you make a radical separation in logic between the one and the many, and the one has this property of infinity, that you've thereby put a limit, you're contradicting yourself, because you've thereby put a limitation on the one by saying it cannot be the many, or it cannot manifest the many.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. That is something that he is making an appeal to the logic. He's making an appeal to the logic to change its habit of finite, this what I call the investment in discreteness, the investment in the finite.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the full experience of the infinite one is not available. We can have the notion, the idea of the dependence and interdependence of the many. So the many, and you know, say for example, Buddhist schools that talk about, you know, the sort of codependent arising, you know. They would also be able to talk about this kind of a interdependence of the many, but not talk about the one, for example. For them, there is no one that exceeds that many, because they are restricting themselves to an empiricism, but a more profound empiricism than the logic of the finite. The mind can go that far, but for the mind to actually posit an infinite oneness, a one being that is infinite, the experience must come with it. And that experience, well, we may say that at some level we do experience that, because that has become us. But that experience is not consciously in front of us. It's not something that we experience all the time, instead of other than in states of trance. And if it is to be our constant experience, then we are talking about a supramental creation or a supramental manifestation. But otherwise, I think the assumption of the infinite one is something that is, you know, we can intuit it as coming from the fact that no discrete reality is not interdependent. But we don't really experience it at this point in its fullness, rather. So we can certainly, I mean, the fallacy of the logic of the finite can be admitted, and the logic of the infinite can be intuited, and we should, you know, cut at that logic of the finite and move towards the other. But to have that full experience, we need to enter into yoga.
Yes, thank you.
In fact, there's a line, one, nor is it, that they depend on the one and exist by its oneness. The depend on the one is sort of understandable by mind, but exist by its oneness is something kind of difficult to comprehend, even though we sort of understand as a logic. But to comprehend or rather apply in our experience in the detailed things, I think it's really difficult. I mean, it sort of challenges the way mind understands or senses things. Somewhere I think Sri Aurobindo says that if mind tries to really apply that, it will lose itself. I mean, it sort of loses its own hold, and if we are into meditation, then it sort of tends to gets transported into another layer or something.
Yeah, indeed. And actually, as you pointed out earlier, this division has been created by the universal mind or by overmind. And so what we actually do find is that that's why I said, until we start being able to enter, even with eyes open, in the condition of Jagrat, into the cosmic mind planes, into the Swapna planes, we don't really have a clear hold of this idea. And it's only in Overmind that this idea becomes concrete. But what he's saying is that, I mean, and this point was made in the previous chapter, that even in inner mind, even at the level of our what is accessible to us, there is a subtler operation in which we see that this logic of the finite is not entirely true, is not true. So to move, he's showing us the direction out, and he's saying that ultimately there is this, unfathomable oneness, we may say, this infinite oneness. And that is what we must experience. But at the same time, we have to begin by not investing ourselves in this sort of logic of the finite. So, in a way, what you said, I mean, to come back to what you said about a logic of the finite being something very difficult to negate because of the habit of mind that is tied to external knowledge. This itself, these paragraphs themselves, this chapter itself, is ultimately a yoga, because it is telling us to practice this different perception. I think we may put in one more paragraph, the next paragraph, because he is continuing to posit these dualities and look at them from different points of view. He took up qualities, then he took up number, and now he'll take up order, he'll take up movement, he'll take up stillness and movement as two polarities, the being and the becoming, the static and the dynamic. So, how about if we read that? And I think, Matteo, would you like to read that?
I'll pass. I have a sore throat. Thank you.
Okay, sure. How about Dan? Dan Wood, would you like to read that?
Sure. Again, we see that there is an infinite pure status and immobile silence of the spirit. We see, too, that there is a boundless movement of the spirit, a power, a dynamic, spiritual, all-containing self-extension of the infinite. Our conceptions, foist upon this perception, in itself valid and accurate, in opposition between the silence and status, and the dynamis and movement, but to the reason and the logic of the infinite, there can be no such opposition. A solely silent and static infinite, an infinite without an infinite power and dynamis and energy, is inadmissible except as the perception of an aspect. A powerless absolute, an impotent spirit, is unthinkable. An infinite energy must be the dynamis of the infinite, and all power must be the potency of the absolute. An illimitable force must be the force of the spirit. But the silence, the status, are the basis of the movement, and eternal immobility is the necessary condition, field, essence even, of the infinite mobility. A stable being is the condition and foundation of the vast action of the force of being. It is when we arrive at something of this silence, stability, immobility, that we can base on it a force and energy which, in our superficial restless state, would be inconceivable. The opposition we make is mental and conceptual. In reality, the silence of the spirit and the dynamis of the spirit are complementary truths and inseparable. The immutable silent spirit may hold its infinite energy silent and immobile within it, for it is not bound by its own forces. It is not their subject or instrument, but it does possess them, does release them, is capable of an eternal and infinite action, does not weary or need to stop, and yet all the time its silent immobility inherent in its action and movement is not for a moment shaken or disturbed or altered by its action and movement. The witness silence of the spirit is there in the very grain of all the voices and workings of nature. These things may be difficult for us to understand because our own surface finite capacity neither direction is limited and our conceptions are based on our limitations. But it should be easy to see that these relative and finite conceptions do not apply to the absolute and infinite.
So, as we see, he's taking his stand at the level of the finite, and that's why he's saying over there that we can intuit, or we can see that this experience of the finite, the experience of, you know, the difference between the individual and the others, different finite entities, the witnesses or statuses of being, and the movements of nature, or these qualities that seem to, you know, create this world or exist in this world, that these are, you know, kind of already a differentiated experience that individuals have in this cosmos. We are seem to be bound by these, but the infinite is not bound by these, and we ourselves are not bound by these if we start moving in our consciousness towards another kind of conception, another kind of experience. So in a way, we find that, you know, all these differentiations that he's talking about are also differentiations that bridge the three statuses of being, Brahman, Purusha, and Ishvara. The status in which we find ourselves is that of the separation of the Purusha and the Prakriti. And that is these two states, the state of being and of the Purusha, which is a witnessing being, static, still, outside of the dynamis of nature and its movements and the movements of nature. Even making this separation is difficult because in this cosmic movement, in the cosmic determination, that which is the witness is ultimately immanent in the activities of the Shakti or of the Prakriti. So there is a certain kind of dynamism of habit, habitual movement, routine movements that determine the laws of the cosmos. At the material level, then at the level of life, there seems to be a little more freedom. But you can also talk about ecosystems and the laws of nature, laws that are a little more random. You may need to deploy a mathematics of chaos, but at the same time, there are laws that have a high degree of predictability. With the mind, we find with human beings, with mind-bound creatures, we find that there is a much greater degree of unpredictability. So there is both predictability and unpredictability at work at all these levels. At the finite level, we find, and this is one of the reasons why this idea of the Purusha and Prakriti, as it emerged in the philosophy called Sankhya, posited many Purushas but one Prakriti. Because it proceeded from an empirical standpoint. What it was saying is that we need, each one of us needs to separate the witnessing self from the activities of nature. That's the first step. because thereby we will find that there is only one nature. It was aiming at separating being from its entrapment in nature. So if we can do that, then we'll find that there is only one nature with the laws of nature that are present in matter, present in life, and present even in our thoughts. But we are not that. But the problem that arises out of that is then, each one of us is a separate witnessing being. Are there many beings and only one nature? And that is also something that he has dealt with in that previous paragraph where he's talking about the one and the many. Even in terms of beings, this fragmentation of the Purushas is because there is the first property of Prakriti, which is Ahankara or ego, that has been cast over the shade of the Purusha, of the Ishvara, to create, or of the Purusha with a capital P, to create the sense of fragmented Purushas. So that is one level of the multiplicity. But there is another level and a truth to the multiplicity, which is the emergence of the psychic being. The fact that the self presentation of the one is occurring through its own fragmentation as many psychic beings. So we have this multiplicity, but ultimately each one of these Purushas, whether we look at it as the witness or as the psychic being, inheres in the cosmic Purusha. The cosmic Purusha has become multiplied or self-multiplied as these many Purushas due to the activity of its own Shakti. So that is where Ishvara comes in. Ishvara, or cosmic Purusha, ultimately is transcendental and originates in supermind. And that is the point that he's trying to make, that this so-called division of being from the Brahman through the Ishvara to the Purusha, and of nature from Maya through Shakti to Prakriti, is ultimately all one. They are stages of the self-presentation of the one. And we are at the bottom rung of that, and so we experience reality first through the mixture of the Purusha and Prakriti, and the subjugation of the Purusha to Prakriti. But from that we can emerge into a observation of the duality of Purusha and Prakriti, and then move further to the unity of Ishvara and Shakti and the identity of Brahman and Maya. So this is the process that he's taking us through. I think we've crossed our time limit for today. And if there are any more questions or comments, we can take it up and then we can stop for the day.
I have a couple of questions, but I think I would like to not address it now, maybe address it at the beginning of the next session, because I actually have to go.
No, that's fine. That's good. We can certainly keep that in mind, and you could even, if you wish, field those questions on the forum. If you send it or if you put it on the forum of the True Person, site, we can all look at it, and I can certainly try to answer it, or we can take it up next time when we convene. What is our next date of meeting? Is it the 28th? The 28th.